This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580 and online at will.illinois.edu. I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for tuning in this afternoon. In this portion of the program, we're going to talk about New Orleans. Our guest is a man who calls New Orleans home. Billy Southern is our guest. He is a staff attorney at the Capitol Appeals Project and co-director of Reprieve US, which is based in New Orleans. He is also the author of Down in New Orleans, Reflections from a Drowned City. 2 years after Katrina, New Orleans continues to struggle. Southern says, post-Katrina, New Orleans hasn't been an easy place to live. It hasn't been an easy place to be in love. It hasn't been an easy place to take care of yourself or see the bright side of things. Those thoughts come from the prologue of Down in New Orleans. While it hasn't been easy, that doesn't mean it isn't worth the struggle. At the end of the book, Southern says he believes the tide will turn. In his words, the important values that animate our democracy were not drowned in the flood. Listeners, I invite you to join the discussion this afternoon with a telephone call. Join us with your questions, your comments. Here are the phone numbers in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. We also have a toll-free number, that number, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Let me tell you a bit more about our guest. He is a graduate of New York University School of Law, and he has written for The Nation and Salon, among other publications. His book, Down in New Orleans, Reflections from a Drowned City, is published by the University of California Press. Again, those phone numbers, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Billy Southern, good afternoon. Welcome.
Great. Thanks so much for having me.
My pleasure. How are you?
I'm doing all right.
Yeah? Is it getting any easier?
Here in New Orleans, things remain pretty troubled. I think that many people listening out there would be very surprised to drive through some of the hardest hit areas of the city to see how little progress has been made.
Yeah. You moved from New York to New Orleans. How did you decide to make that move?
I came to New Orleans to practice law at the office that I sort of continue to work with, doing the work that I do, which is representation of men and women facing the death penalty in their appeals. So I, unlike most people, I actually came to New Orleans for work because I was sort of inspired to come down to the South to do work that I regard as sort of civil rights work.
And you have really come to make New Orleans your home. It seems that New Orleans claimed you.
Yeah, well, I have the fervor of a convert for New Orleans. I find it to be a wonderfully dynamic and interesting city, especially in a time when so much of America appears sort of homogenized. You know, when you pull off the interstate, whether you're in Illinois or California or New York, things often look the same. But Louisiana and New Orleans in particular has a great sense of place, and that sense of place is very connected both to the landscape and the geography. And then in New Orleans, I think there's probably even something even deeper than that, a connection to the history of the place and to the people and the culture there. So for Americans who are used to the increasing homogeneity of the landscape, I think New Orleans is a real stark contrast to that. It's a place with a great sense of place.
Yeah. And the people that we meet in your book, Down in New Orleans, for so many of them, I think that sums up how they feel about their city. That those folks that are there, they want to be there, come hell or high water, no pun, and I didn't intend the pun at all. But they are determined to be there.
Yeah, people are very committed to New Orleans. Unlike almost any other place in America, where you can imagine, everyone who is currently in New Orleans chooses to be there because we were all forcibly evacuated. We all essentially needed to choose to return, and in so choosing, you know, we were up against great obstacles in rebuilding our homes and rebuilding our communities. So people who, I think many of the people who weren't committed or who considered living in other places, they did so. And I think what we have left are people who generally chose to come back, and then alternatively people who came back because they really had no other option. So actually there is some contrast there, but I think in general the citizenry of the city is more engaged than ever in the life and the future of the city, in part because I think we've all made sacrifices to return.
Yeah. As time passes, does it become less likely that those who fled and have not yet returned will return?
I think that that's probable. I think it's interesting, the history of the city, which is something that I try to sort of dwell on at some length in the book, trying to focus on the ways in which some of the things that horrified us and frightened us about that happened after the storm had their seeds in the environment in the decades and centuries prior to the storm. But one hard reality in New Orleans is that while it hit a high watermark in terms of population in the 1960s of 650,000, it had lost nearly 200,000 residents prior to the storm, due to a lot of the same factors that I think that make it hard to live there now: failing schools, lack of economic opportunities, high crime, and many other things. So New Orleans was already struggling well before the storm. So I think when we look at people choosing not to return, I think it's hard to be too surprised, given how so many New Orleanians were poorly served. Despite how wonderful the city is, they were poorly served by the things that the city did offer, like education and other things, which were really failing for quite a long time prior to Hurricane Katrina.
Yeah. In the book, you write of hearing Andre Codrescu on the radio not long after the storm, and one of the things he said in this radio piece was, "We already know who's going to pay for all of this, the poor." And then you say in the book that you've never been to a city in the United States whose life and character were so defined by the struggles of its poorest citizens. What are those struggles? How do they define the city? Maybe you tell us about St. Thomas.
I live two blocks from what used to be the St. Thomas Projects, which were built with great optimism in the 1930s. They were actually built with one of the central pieces of New Deal legislation, and the loan that was used to construct these really well-built brick buildings was actually signed by Roosevelt himself. So this was these housing projects for low-income people were built with great optimism, and they were built to replace the slum housing that existed in these communities. So this sort of market-based housing that was available to low-income people, where people were living in really dreadful conditions. So when the St. Thomas was opened, it provided an alternative for people. People could, through the generosity of and competence of government, they could be provided with the kinds of homes they wouldn't dreamed of having otherwise. It really was that way for the first residents. Fast forward 60 years, mm-hmm. this became a community that was almost exclusively minority. It was initially built actually for white residents, and there was actually another project, the Magnolia, built for black residents. But by the mid-90s, this was a nightmarish place, a place of great, of staggering poverty, of staggering crime, the kinds of things that I think most Americans would be appalled to realize were, to see that fellow Americans were suffering through. And I think in so much of that we see the history of at least part of the 20th century, from a time when we had a great sort of civic optimism about what government could do, to the late 90s when the people who were running government were increasingly hostile to the possibility that government could contribute to the public good, so that the St. Thomas houses, rather than being kept up, rather than services being provided to the residents there, all of those things were gutted out in the decades leading up to the 90s, and ultimately they were demolished. And that's actually what's happening in the rest of the city as well. The other housing projects, many of which were built in the same era, many of which were built with great competence by artisans and will withstand floods and storms in the future, will be replaced by shoddily constructed, brightly colored buildings under a new policy, which has to do with private enterprise and public-private partnerships. So it's a frustrating thing to me that in the city where one of the biggest crises that we face is a housing crisis, that that the political realities of the day dictate not that we rebuild these well-built housing projects, but in fact that we bulldoze them. So it's a frustrating thing to me, but I think it does, like so many things in New Orleans, reflect much bigger and broader political trends that are going on in the United States these days.
Yeah, what kind of discussion is going on in New Orleans among New Orleanians about the role of government and about who is going to rebuild the city?
Well, I think that there's a lot of frustration. You know, New Orleans and Louisiana in general, we've been poorly served for a long time by the people who were supposed to lead us, and that's the Republicans and the Democrats. So it's really across the board. No one is surprised to hear that Louisiana has a long-standing history and culture of corruption, and I think when we say that, we almost forget the fact that corruption almost always comes down heaviest on the neediest people. So when there's graft, for instance, in a school district, the people who are suffering are these students who aren't getting books. When there's graft in the public health care system, it's the poorest people who can't afford any other alternative who end up holding the bag. So, you know, in New Orleans, where we see that that inadequate investment in our levees ended up destroying the city, it's difficult, I think, for people to think, well, government is the solution to these problems, in part because they've been given so many examples of government failing them that people have simply become cynical. I think looking at history, we see that that government can play a potent and energizing role in defending its poor citizens. But I think New Orleanians have been given few reasons to believe that. And I think that we see that in the most recent election of Bobby Jindal, a Republican and a minority who won a pretty overwhelming victory in a primary that put him right into the governor's mansion. And the platform he ran on more than anything else was, I'm not corrupt and I'm competent. And in Louisiana, that took the day.
Billy Southern, our guest this afternoon in this portion of the Afternoon Magazine. He's the author of Down in New Orleans, Reflections from a Drowned City. This is the Afternoon Magazine. My name's Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with questions, comments. Join us with a phone call, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Let's take a call now on the toll-free line, line 4. Where are you calling from?
Oswego.
Okay,
Illinois.
Oswego. Hi.
Good afternoon. Yeah, this is a great discussion. You brought up a lot of good. Actually, you kind of answered a couple of questions. The reason why, to me, I've been down there. I have friends of mine that live in Monroe, Louisiana, and I've driven actually from Illinois all the way down to New Orleans and back. And when I was down there before Katrina. To New Orleans, it was a mess. It was a cesspool, and I'm sure you're probably talking about the same thing today, the same area. So I have no doubt in my mind that the reason why people didn't go back there is because there's nothing to go back to. As far as you know, the unemployment and the strife it's been caused down there. But my point I want to bring up is the levee system. Now, I've been to Europe. I've been to Amsterdam. I've been to Holland a couple of times. And their levee system is so much better over there than it is here. And to this day, I can't figure out why we didn't have that same kind of system down there. I mean, anybody who knows that if you're going to rebuild down there, the same thing's going to happen eventually in another 100 years. So unless we get our act together, and my concern would be, has anybody even tried to go to Holland or go to Europe and take a look at some of these levee systems up in the North Sea to try and maybe duplicate that? Because I can see that happening again. And if we're relying on the government to do this, that's null and void because they're impotent as it is.
Well, I think that's a great observation about the way things could be done in terms of flood protection in other places. And I think the caller's completely right. In Europe, the flood protection systems that they have are vastly more sophisticated, and protect areas that are much more vulnerable than even New Orleans. And I think in that we see a real contrast between an American style of governance and a European style of governance. An American style, I think, that's leaning more towards a sort of a libertarian type mode, and a European style that leans in more in terms of a liberal mode. So I think that in New Orleans, I think we could have those levies that could be the pride of the nation. But instead, the levels that we're willing to invest are so meager that we're not willing to do that. And because we're not willing to do that, I think the caller's correct that portions of the city which are prone to flood will flood again, destroying many lives. And I think that that's too bad. I think, if we reshaped our priorities as a nation, I think that we could create these kinds of public works that as Americans we could be incredibly proud of. Instead, I think we're seeing a public work system that's really beginning to fall apart, not because of the impossibility that government can actually do good in our lives, but because of systematic neglect to these public goods.
I was wondering, is the same mayor down there, Ray Nagin?
Indeed, we still do have Mayor Ray Nagin, for better or for worse.
There's a problem right in itself. From what I've been told, that guy's as corrupt as anybody else there is, and I think before anybody starts, and I'm not a George Bush fan, all right, or anything else when it has to do with government, but there's the guy that started a problem that he didn't take responsibility for, and until they get rid of him and start doing some kind of good down there, nothing will ever change. But that's my comment, and it's nice to hear somebody talking about that area. Maybe we'll get some private help, because I think that's the only way it's going to get done is a private help. Thanks.
Well, just to comment on that, I just think in responding to that comment about the private assistance, and I think it's amazing what private people have done for New Orleans. Tons of people have come to New Orleans to donate their time. Companies have come and donated money. But ultimately, the billions of dollars that are required to rebuild the city, to create a safe city in terms of levies and in terms of so many things. Unfortunately, that's never going to be adequately served by the private sector. That's necessarily the grounds of the public sector. So I think, as cynical as I think we have all become about the capacity of the public sector to accomplish things, I think really as citizens, rather than give up on the public sector, what we really need to do is just demand more. And I think it is discouraging when someone like Nagin, who failed the city, is reelected, or even worse yet, someone like William Jefferson, our congressman, who's manifestly corrupt, is reelected. And that, it reflects poorly on the sort of choices that we're making. But again, I think that we really need to demand better, not to simply give up on the public sector.
Yeah. Speaking of the public sector, and I've got another caller I want to get to pretty quickly here, but this idea of infrastructure, I mean, this is a health and safety issue. This is public health. This is domestic security. Why do you suppose this hasn't been a bigger issue?
Well, I think nationally we see we're very responsive to sort of crisis, but we don't. It's the old thing that all of us know, and an ounce of prevention is better than a pound of cure. But I think that it's difficult in this era where I think that the legislatures they're not interested in spending money on upkeep and maintenance of these vast public works that protect us and keep us safe and moving forward, because there's just not that much interest in that. Either there's greater interest in slashing taxes, or alternatively in trying to do something new and different. Maybe it's not sexy to sort of maintain our bridges, but as we see in parts of the country, it's quite critical. I wish I could say that America had learned a great lesson from what happened in New Orleans, but I'm afraid that at this point it's very difficult for me to take that view, given both how the city's future has been planned and based on other things that are going on elsewhere in the country.
Mm. We've got some listeners who would like to talk with you. Billy, let's go next to a listener in Champaign. Line 1, you're on the air with Billy Southern.
Hi, Mr. Southern.
Hi, how are you?
I have to say that one of the main problems in New Orleans has to be the corruption. Like, I mean, if you were to research in depth the amount of money that was sent down there for those levies and then just disappeared, it would blow you away. I'd be willing to bet anything that if you were to put your finger on a single problem that this this city has, it's their own government. I mean, they insist on electing incompetent people and corrupt people, and they get them again and again and again. I mean, who said you get the government you deserve? Well, in New Orleans, they got what they deserve.
Well, I think I definitely see your point, and I sympathize with that. You know, as a citizen of New Orleans, I feel often disappointed at the people who are elected to lead us. But a lot of these, I think, are top-down issues. You know, the kind of emergency response that we saw immediately following Hurricane Katrina, with Michael Brown running FEMA, with George Bush hanging out at Crawford instead of coming to the aid of the people of New Orleans, or really recognizing the nature of the problem. You know, the people of New Orleans, I think, if they want to look to the people who failed them, you know, I think there's really no end of people, whether it's in the federal government, the state government, or the local government. So, you know, I don't think we can say that one particular party is to blame. But I probably do disagree that that the principal problem is corruption. I agree that corruption is a problem. I think that the principal problem is a general disinvestment in the city. Is a sense that the city just was sort of left to die long before Hurricane Katrina. And I think part of the reason why I think that it's not simply the corruption issue and it's not just specific to New Orleans is that I think if you look around the country, you see so many cities struggling with so many of the same problems that New Orleans is. Places like, you know, Newark, New Jersey, or Detroit, or, you know, Oakland, or, you know, and so many other small places and large places in between suffer from so many of the same problems of poverty and violence. And just the sense that the poorest people are just being incredibly misserved that go on in New Orleans. So while I am sympathetic to the view that that we are not electing the people that should lead us, I think that it's a top down issue, and the people who are providing leadership, you know, at the top, you know, people like the President of the United States and you know what was until very recently the very conservative legislature, you know, I think that places like New Orleans and the many other places like New Orleans have been incredibly misserved, not only by their own government, but by those other federal folks as well.
Quick follow-up from the
very
listener.
Very unfair for you to blame the Federalists. When there's an accident in New York City, they seem to handle it, and when there's one out in California, they seem to handle it. The state and local government in those areas is so completely incompetent that to consider that if you just gave them more money, you'd get a solution to your problem is insane.
The scope of the problem in California and in New York simply aren't comparable to what happened in New Orleans, simply in terms of acreage and number of people affected. But secondarily, the what happened in New Orleans was a storm, a sort of a mediocre storm, came toward New Orleans, and it broke these poorly designed levees. The levees were designed by the Army Corps of Engineers, and there was a design defect, and they collapsed, and huge portions of the city flooded. It's not a problem with local leadership. The local leadership didn't design the levees; they were designed by the Army Corps of Engineers. So, you know, I definitely see your point, but I guess I just disagree.
Let's take another call now. A listener in Urbana on line two. Hi.
Hello. Yes, I read an article several months ago regarding the repair of the drainage systems in New Orleans, and perhaps you can fill in the blanks because I can't remember, but I'm pretty sure it said that they could not improve the drainage system. They could only repair it back to its present state. Are its past state, which seems ridiculous because we all know that the past systems failed. So to bring it back to where it was is just another invitation to failure. Do you know any more about it than I do?
Yeah, I think that, you know, there's a bunch of discrete issues when we're talking about, you know, the future of the city, and drainage is one of them. You know, once water gets into the city, how do you get the water out of the city? In the situation like what happened during Katrina, where the levees collapsed, even if you had an incredible drainage system, it wouldn't have made a difference because there was simply so much water pouring into the city from the lake. So, you know, you could push it back out in the lake and it simply come right back into the city. And then you have additional problems with things like wetlands erosion and the lack of wetlands which used to protect the city. But so I think that what you say is true, is that the drainage system can be repaired, but it can only pump so much water. So really what we need to focus on, I think, as a city would be creating a levee system which actually kept the water out of the city, so that the drainage system could do its job. And then, you know, even more so, to really begin to sort of relook at the way we orient in terms of our relationship with the wetlands, and maybe using nature as opposed to technology to really begin to protect the city, because it's commonly understood that the wetlands south of New Orleans provided this incredibly strong natural buffer that kept the city safe for so long. And then there are other, I think, really important things, too, that I try to discuss in my book in terms of smart building and smart design. And I don't think most people realize this, but the only portions of the city that flooded were those that were built in the 20th century. The core city that most people would go to if they were on vacation, you know, the French Quarter, the Garden District, you know, all of these historic areas that run along the river, none of them flooded because they were all built on high ground, because they were built when I think people had a different relationship to nature. The areas of the city that flooded were all sort of suburban-style developments that were built by developers after land was drained, and those are the areas that really flooded the worst. So I would have hoped that coming back after Hurricane Katrina, we would have decided that we would design smarter and better, but in part because the recovery has been so oriented in this sort of laissez-faire mode, the portions of the city that were most vulnerable, that were built in the second half of the 20th century, are sort of slowly creeping back, and those are the areas that probably, regardless of what we do in terms of flood protection, those areas will flood again. And sadly, people all over the country will likely pay the bill.
Could you tell me too how much of the grasslands do they lose every year due to erosion, and how big is the dead zone in the Gulf?
I couldn't tell you exactly, but it's one of those figures that we hear in New Orleans all the time, whether it's, you know, a football field every hour or something like that. But it's some sort of staggering erosion, and it's occurring not due to natural causes, but actually due largely to the oil business, which has carved through it all of these canals, which has infiltrated it with salt water, and then also actually due to the way we've controlled the Mississippi. In the past, the Mississippi would break its banks and silt would go from the river into the wetlands, and that would keep the wetlands strong. But because now we have the Mississippi channeled with these concrete walls on either side, that silt never goes into the wetlands, and the wetlands is never able to regenerate. Mm-hmm. And that's a huge issue. I think it's an issue about the way we, in modern times, respect and work with nature, as opposed to hemming it in. But it's a big crisis, and I think the dead zone is a similar issue. Part of what's happening is that all that material is getting shot straight into the Gulf, as opposed to breaking its banks periodically.
Let's take another call now. A listener in Urbana, line 3. Hi.
Well, the old Reagan cliche has come up that government is the problem, and it seems to me this is one of the most insidious heritage of the Reagan administration. If you look at what we have been successful at, our road systems were built by a federal program. Even our much vaunted state universities are the result of a federal program, the land grant system going back to Lincoln. And I could go on and on, but that isn't the main point here. It seems to me part of the problem, at least in Louisiana, isn't a failure of government, but that the government that existed for a couple of hundred years was brilliantly successful for the white upper-class minority and disenfranchised the lower-class white and black minorities. And this has corrupted any later government that it's very difficult to overcome. I think we're making some progress, but I think this is the heritage of the Old South. Would you care to comment?
Yeah, I think on your first point, I entirely agree with you. This cynicism about government definitely stems from the Reagan era, you know, that government's not the solution, government is the problem. And I think after you take that perspective and then consistently gut out any capacity government has to do to help people, you begin to convince people. But I think you're totally right. So many of the things that as Americans we're proud of have been the successful products of government, things like that, and then immensely popular things like Social Security even. On the second point, I think it's clear to me, and I work in the criminal justice system, and I represent very poor people generally charged with crimes, and I definitely see in my work and in and in the Katrina situation generally a lot of class conflict here in the South and in New Orleans in general, and definitely that all those dynamics played out in ways after Hurricane Katrina that I think were really eye-opening to a lot of people. So while I certainly agree with you that we do live in the legacy of the Old South, for instance, I live in a home that has a building attached to the back that's called the Slave Quarters. Another house that I lived in had a building attached to the back that was called the Slave Quarters, and the house had been built by very wealthy blacks. New Orleans is a complicated city that way, but we also very much live in that complicated racial history, and I think it is manifest in our current situation all the time. For instance, actually right now I'm on my way up to visit a client at Angola, which is our state penitentiary. It's called Angola because it was populated previously by slaves from Angola, and now it's a plantation that's a prison. So without offering any particular commentary on that fact, I think it just goes to show how in the South in particular, and in a place like Louisiana even more so, we very much do live in that legacy, that very complicated and difficult legacy. And I hope that you're right. I hope that that things are changing and improving. And I very much hope that the situation in New Orleans, where people saw on their television things that horrified them about people living in poverty, end up making a difference in the future.
Let's take another call now. A listener in Champaign on line one. Hi.
Hi. The previous caller pretty much stated a large part of what I was going to say, but let me just mention that if we had a more liberal, constructive government, such as under FDR, or Kennedy, or LBJ, I would believe the approach to reconstructing New Orleans would be very different. And in relationship to all these callers that talk about private enterprise and government and so forth, one of the definitions of fascism comes very close to government run by corporations. But that aside, there's a book which I saw reviewed on interviewed a lady named Naomi Klein, I believe called Shock Value, and she's talking about how somewhat Milton Friedman-esque policies are being employed in reconstructing New Orleans. I don't know if you're familiar with that book, but I'll just hang up and listen. Thank you.
Yeah, I think that Naomi Klein has identified some things that are incredibly important about what's going on in New Orleans and what she refers to as disaster capitalism. And what she's pointing to is that there are these moments of vulnerability in our democracy when the nation is stunned by some, grand event that allow us to give up things that we wouldn't otherwise surrender. She uses New York as an example, what happened on September 11th, and then what led to sort of carving out of people's civil rights and civil liberties, as well as the invasion of Iraq. And I think in New Orleans she sees similar things in terms of the way the recovery is going. And I think that those are important things. I very much hope that the opposite thing happens. I'm not necessarily optimistic about that, but rather than the destruction in New Orleans leading to a less just city, I very much hope that over the long haul, that New Orleans becomes, what happened in New Orleans becomes a lesson to other communities about how vulnerable they are, about how vulnerable the poorest communities in their communities are, so that we begin to sort of reorganize the way we do business. And I think that there's some indication that that's happening. I think that the failure in New Orleans, it took the wind out of the sails, I think, of a lot of real strong fiscal conservatives. Because in the end, like I was saying before, it'd be impossible for us to rebuild New Orleans without the generosity of the rest of the nation. Certainly without at least some effort to rebuild the levees and the wetlands. So while I think there's some attraction, I think, among some people to view us as these sort of rugged individuals who can make it on our own, you know, I think in the end, you know, we're as Americans, we live in communities, and when we see people suffering, even if they're not immediately next to us, we feel like we want to do something. And I think that the sort of the spirit that sort of conservative mode of government sort of preys on is often, I think, a very selfish motive that people have. And I think that you know, when people look at what's happening in a place like New Orleans, they want to be generous, not selfish.
Let's take another call now. A listener in Champaign, line two. Hi.
Hi. is there any replacement for the 1,000 medics that were freely offered by Cuba to New Orleans at the time of Katrina? And is it still needed? And are the many Spanish-speaking laborers who have replaced or displaced North American workers in the rebuilding as bad as what I suspect? From what I've seen, some of the living conditions of the workers are beyond description.
I can just answer the first question very, very briefly. I know that we turned away the medics from Cuba, and certainly I have a friend who served as a medic in New Orleans immediately after Katrina, and he was one of very few doctors who was there among a population of people who were suffering greatly. So certainly those people were turned away, no one replaced them. Concerning the second point regarding the increased Latino population in New Orleans since the storm, I actually wrote a chapter in my book about that. And people, the people who came to New Orleans to help rebuild and to work in New Orleans in that population have been living in some pretty awful conditions. People came to New Orleans and were living outdoors, living in abandoned homes, living in all kinds of bad situations, and then were being systematically taken advantage of by folks who would either refuse to pay them, steal their wages, threaten to call immigration after a week's work, and that kind of thing. And part of that is because I think New Orleans doesn't have the kind of organized Spanish-speaking population established there that exists other places. But, you know, my hope is that in the long term, that group of people coming to New Orleans will become citizens of the city and contribute to the sort of interesting and dynamic culture that has existed here. And I think that there's signs that that's happening. So I think initially, definitely, there was a real crisis in that area. I'm hoping, at least, and I think there's reason to believe that as that community becomes more settled in New Orleans, there are going to be increased resources for them to draw on, and the capacity of people to be opportunistic and take advantage of them will diminish.
The caller want to follow up? No, okay. Thanks for the call this afternoon. Maybe you would tell us a little bit about that doctor. You write about him in the book. Jeff Rouse, I believe, is his name.
Yeah, my friend Jeff, I was sitting in the living room of my friend's house in Oxford, Mississippi, where my wife and me and my dog and my friend all evacuated to, and they were very generous to put me up there. And we were sitting there watching CNN, and Anderson Cooper, you know, with a very dramatic Anderson Cooper-esque intro, said, you know, we have a doctor on the ground here in New Orleans, and he's a psychiatrist, and he came in with a gun, and he's trying to help people. And I joked to my wife, oh, I said that, you know, that's probably Jeff, because he's a psychiatrist. And then there he was on the television, and he looked incredibly scared, and he looked incredibly shocked and pained, and he just described to the television audience what he'd seen, and what he'd seen was awful, which was that there were hundreds of people who needed medical assistance, and that him, as a psychiatrist, he's not like a general practitioner, that he was one of two doctors that he had seen to try to serve all of these people. And he was just, it was incredibly emotional for me to see him there, because it really made me feel like that there were very few people who were looking out for New Orleans, so few that in fact my own friend was one of two doctors in the city performing heroically. So I definitely felt proud for my friend, but I felt very sad for my city that's how low things had sunk. And I guess that's a very particular problem regarding the immediate response to the disaster, which definitely was, I think, in my view, a failure. You know, but at this point, I think we can identify sort of three separate periods which the city has been failed in. The long period running up to the storm, where the city was allowed to sink into desperate poverty. The immediate aftermath of the storm, where the city suffered without any sort of rapid response by any government entity. And now the long-term situation, in which the long-term recovery of the city is hampered by both lack of funds and lack of vision. So I hope that there's a fourth phase in which we're talking very optimistically about the future of New Orleans, one of America's great American cities. But what I would like to emphasize to people out there is that this is really a bellwether for American democracy. And I think when we look at New Orleans, if we simply see it as this crazy city that's, you know, down south somewhere that has little relationship to our communities, I think that we're really, I think that's very short-sighted. I think that if New Orleans is allowed to suffer and die due to its own problems and due to problems not of its own making, I think we can be pretty certain that we're going to see this repeat itself in other communities that are vulnerable to natural disaster, and there are many, many across the country. So I think when we look at New Orleans, I think it'd be very risky if we saw it as some otherness. You know, in fact, what's most important about New Orleans is how it's the same as the rest of the country, not what makes us different.
Yeah. Before we wrap up here, I want to ask you, because you're a defense attorney and you write quite a bit in down in New Orleans about the horrors at the New Orleans jail and folks that were incarcerated for a long period of time for some, of course, I'm sure, serious criminals, but others who found themselves locked in a cell. They were being held for, you know, something really minor, all these horror stories. And I'm wondering today, what is the story in terms of what's going on in the jails, in the courthouses, in the parishes of New Orleans?
You know, I think that's another very troubling reality of life in New Orleans. You know, New Orleans is almost certainly going to be the nation's leader in homicides again this year, and not by any small measure either. We'll probably be 50% higher in terms of murder rate than the next closest American city, which is pretty staggering. And in my own life, I lost a friend to violence earlier this year, a woman who was murdered in her own home when she was protecting her child. You know, and that's horrifying to me. You know, I view it personally as a consequence of so many of the other social problems that exist in New Orleans. But certainly, on a minute-to-minute basis, you know, we need a real invigorated effort to try to keep the people in the city safe. And the wheels of the criminal justice system in New Orleans have literally fallen off. The district attorney just resigned under pressure last week. You know, we have, you know, it's routine to see in the newspaper on a Sunday morning that there's been six murders over the course of the weekend, and we're talking about in the city of 300,000. So we're really, it's really a desperate time in that regard. And as concerned as I am about the rights of criminal defendants, as a criminal defense attorney, as a citizen of New Orleans, I'm also incredibly concerned about the safety of the people and about the fact that especially the people who live in the poorest neighborhoods live in circumstances where they are justifiably afraid to leave their homes at night. You know, even in other communities, people are afraid to walk around the streets of New Orleans at night. And maybe that's not as big of a problem in a place like the French Quarter, where the tourists visit, but, you know, it's a very difficult way to live. And I think at a certain point, it becomes a, you know, it almost becomes a human rights or a civil rights issue. You know, the people of New Orleans are afraid to leave their homes. And I know that same reality exists in other parts of the country. I feel like the country, as a country, we're not facing, we're not sort of facing down crime the way we did at one point as a sort of a big national issue. But I think that we really need to have a re-energized conversation about those issues, especially because in a place like New Orleans, it's manifest that this tough-on-crime policy hasn't been a success. Louisiana leads the world in incarceration rates. So you'd expect that if incarceration alone provided an answer to violent crime, that Louisiana, rather than being one of the most violent places in the country, would be one of the safest. But in fact, we see quite the opposite. Yeah. So I'm hoping that what happens in New Orleans, it sparks a debate about, ways in which we can respond to violent crime that would be somewhat more productive than what we've done to date.
Yeah. I've got one last question for you, and we've got to be really quick here because otherwise we're going to run over seriously in terms of time. You say, poor communities need police on their streets, but they need to be served by police who are treated with dignity and who consequently are better able to treat the communities they serve with sensitivity and decency. A quick comment here. How is the New Orleans Police Department coping? How are they dealing with all the problems that they've got?
I think that, like so many other things in New Orleans, the people who bravely serve on the police department in New Orleans suffer from a genuine lack of leadership. I respect the work that people are trying to do. Certainly I spend time with the detectives that were investigating the murder of my friend, but I don't suspect they'll identify that the individual that did that crime, in part because they're so incredibly under-resourced. It's much like many other things. I think to a public that's used to seeing CSI on television, I think they'd be shocked to see that, the city of New Orleans is unable to even competently get fingerprints off of a crime scene. So we're not talking about, whether we're going to compare the carpet fibers to a factory in China to determine who the real killer is. We're talking about a city that is unable to adequately take photographs of crime victims and not lose them. So it's a real contrast, I think, again, to what we would hope to see in an American city to what we actually see. And while there's definitely many figures to point out about why, I think the fact that we need to confront it as an issue, I think, is inevitable.
Mm. There, we've got to leave it. Billy Southern, thank you very much for talking with us this afternoon.
Thanks so much for having me.
Billy Southern is the author of Down in New Orleans, Reflections from a Drowned City. The book is published by the University of California Press.